You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Welcome to this week's episode of Drinks with Tony. And what great timing to have Adam Steiner on the show this week. He's the author of Darker with the Dawn, Nick Cave's Songs of Love and Death. Why? Because Nick Cave is on tour in Europe right now, and there's all this cool footage being posted on YouTube of the live shows. There's one that so far that's my favorite, and I think it's at the Athens show. It's during O Children, and there's this kid that's actually pulled up onto the stage, and Nick sings to him for a minute, and there's just this beautiful moment where the kid stands there and then just immediately hugs Nick. He like clings to Nick Cave, and it's such an authentic moment. And the kid, he's probably 9 or 10 years old. He's wearing a Nirvana shirt, which I have to say just feels very surreal to those of us who were around during the 80s and 90s and seeing Nick in intimate venues, Nick being kind of our little secret. And it wasn't general knowledge of to know who Nick Cave was, much less Nirvana. Now Nick Cave is playing stadiums and Nirvana is forever in history as one of the greats of all time. I was in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's the transit system is called BART, which is kind of the extended subway system. Say you're in New York, it's like Long Island Railroad, I think it's what it's called. Anyway, in the late 80s, was it? No, this had to be the 90s. In the 90s, I was on BART, the commuter train for San Francisco, and Bjork, yes, that Bjork, was on the same train, and she was kind of like right there. And this is when she was in the Sugar Cubes, and I adored her. But I didn't want to be a fan whore, so I didn't talk to her. I just sat there. But I was wearing my Nick Cave t-shirt, and her friend asked me if I read And the Ass Saw the Angel. So I had a great conversation with her friend, because us weirdos who knew Nick Cave at that time would find each other. And that turned into a wonderful conversation where Bjork just came in on it. And Bjork, she had all these jelly beans. So her and her friend shared, and me, and we shared jelly beans on our train ride back to San Francisco. Nick Cave brought us together. Yes, us weirdos who were changed by him. And I'm still changed by him. So much so that I started a series on my Substack called Nick Cave and the Jehovah's Witness. Since he changed my life in 1990, when I actually became aware of him. Wait, did I find him or did he find me? I became aware of him and I went to see the 1990 tour for The Good Son. And there's a track on that record called The Witness Song. And I totally identified with it as a Jehovah's Witness. I clung to it. And also it redefined its meaning to me over the years, which kind of led to creating Nick Cave and the Jehovah's Witness on my Substack, DuchesneSubstack.com, if you'd like to check it out. Also, let me tell you why I hate myself a little bit. Because one of the major reasons I don't go see live shows anymore, especially at huge venues, is because everyone has their phone device out and it's way up in the air capturing the moment instead of being in the moment and blocking everyone that's behind them. Like, who doesn't do that? Well, I saw the Swans the last few times and Michael Girard shuts down immediately anyone holding up a device. So thank you, Michael. I wish more artists were like you. Because especially at a Swan show, just being in the moment is about being in the moment. But kind of like Nick Cave. But then, here I am in my apartment across the globe, looking up Nick Cave on YouTube, seeing him in Athens or in Berlin, recorded on those damn devices. And I adore seeing those live moments in time just on the computer moments after they're uploaded by the idiot who put up his iPhone. But thank you, idiot, for putting up your iPhone, because I adore what you're doing. You see how much there's a self-hatred happening there? Hey, kids, you know, when I was young, I used to have to buy bootleg VHS copies for Nick Cave's live shows. Poorly recorded, and I had to get those from the want ads in the back of Maximum Rock and Roll magazine. And that was actually a lovely experience, because you got your kind of crappy live version, but you invited all your weirdo friends over to watch Nick Cave do this show that was a pirated type video in the corner of a room where they were performing. But now you just take out your damn devices and you miss the important moments of your shows, seeing Nick Cave, and I get to consume them with joy. The irony is not lost on me. Where is the balance? I don't know. So this week on Drinks with Tony, it's all about Nick Cave and Adam Steiner's book. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Nick Cave, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Hi, I'm Adam Steiner, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony. Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Adam Steiner. He's the author of Darker with the Dawn, Nick Cave's Songs of Love and Death. Adam, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. Feeling full of love, not too much of the death, thankfully, but that's probably the sunshine.
You're in the UK right now, so you have sunshine today.
Yep, this is our day. This is the one.
And I'm taking your time during the moment when sun settles on your part of the world.
Yeah, but it's okay. I was out there a bit today. I went to Portugal, so I think that took the edge off, you know.
Oh, where'd you go in Portugal?
Algarve. Okay. Very near Faro Airport.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, I love Portugal. I was there last year, mostly in Porto, and then in a small town called Guilherme, which is right near Braga. And it's stunning. Like, Portugal is like stunning.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it, because it's the way the light hits the buildings, how it happens. I just sit there and I just look up and go, this doesn't happen in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I believe it. It doesn't happen much in the UK, to be fair. It's like it's the similar kind of light you have in the south of France, which we all now associate with, you know, the impressionist painters, but it's this like deep, rich, intense blue, and it's weirdly like consistent, you know.
Yeah,
it's solid.
It's almost like a soul refresh. It's like getting a wash from the sky. Getting cleansed.
Yeah, I would say unyielding, but in a good way.
Yeah, no wonder you're more on the Nick Cave love side than the death side of things right now. What's that? I'm sorry.
Now he has a tan, so he's that's his reformation. You know, from pale goth.
Right, to, right.
Slightly tanned guy in a dark suit.
It's so true. I didn't even think of that. He's got a lot of sun these days, and Brighton doesn't get a lot of sun, does it? I mean, it's just coastal, or does it?
I don't know. Probably pretty good. You know, you can't get too much further south.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Without skipping over.
Do you do the same insane thing that I do as a fan of Nick Cave? Do you, like, he's touring right now, and I think he was just in Ireland, and do you jump on YouTube to watch some of the live stuff that he's doing?
Some of it, not the whole set, but I should be going to the Brighton gig.
No way! Yeah, oh, that's gonna be fantastic. That's like the bit. That's like
kind of a homecoming thing.
Yeah, and the other thing that happens in Europe, which is fascinating to me, and I think it happened even through the 80s and 90s, was he was always booked at festivals, Where when he came to the States, he was more booked at smaller venues where there was like lots of smoking and drinking and it was dark. And I just couldn't fathom like see him in him outdoors just made zero sense to me. And but the Brighton show, oh, but the problem with the festivals is they cut the set short because there's
Yeah,
so only so much
sure.
time. So when he plays the festivals, it's like they're cutting about 40 minutes of their usual live set, I would think, at least.
Yeah, for sure. But I think it's only really sort of since, let's say, like the 2000s, with something like Abattoir Blues, that's when they kind of grew to like stadium level, arena, big kind of band. And now that's all of it. They can't do small, intimate stuff so much,
Oh,
they did
it
with
hurts my soul,
Mushroom.
man. And I'm not, but I it hurts my soul in a great way because what better person and musician on earth should be playing stadiums? Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I'm like, good for you.
Yeah,
Good for
sure.
you. You're making music taste for the general public a lot better because, stadium rock in my day was Winger. And then it's like, am I going to go see Winger or am I going to see Nick Cave at a small club? It's like, I'm going to Nick Cave. Like, you guys go do your weird cocaine binge over at the Winger show.
I just take a note here, like Google Winger later. I'm sorry.
I aged on that one. I aged on that one.
If it was Wings, I'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, I got you. But like,
Oh, that's
that one's.
previous. Yeah, so I'm looking at like mid late 80s big time stars. Not that I saw Nick in those days. I was too young. My first show was 1990. And what was your first tour? What was your first show?
Mine weirdly would be nothing old school at all. My first one would be the Carnage tour that he and Warren Ellis did.
Oh, that
So
was awesome.
yeah, it was great. The Royal Albert, and it was interesting because it was like brand new recent stuff post lockdown, So it was a strange, and it was obviously the return of gigs as well. And then he couldn't get the whole band together as well. So it's like me and Warren will do some stuff. And the backing singers, and it worked really well. Very stripped back,
Yes, 'cause I haven't
and newer material.
Yeah, totally. I haven't seen the last Bad Seed show I saw was 2014, and then I saw Carnage, the Carnage tour, and the Carnage tour was one of the most. It's probably in my top five Nick Cave shows, and I've seen him about 30 times or so. So it's like that was that, and part of it I think was we were coming out of the lockdowns, and then part of it on the ticket it said mask required. If you're going to come to this venue, and most people threw their masks off, and I did too, because I'm like, hey, if I'm dying tonight, I'm dying singing Nick Cave songs, because I'm sick to death of pretending that we're all going to die. And I know, and some people died, that's a tragedy, but at the same time, I gotta live, man, and I'm going to live to die tonight, and that was the Carnage show.
And yeah, and you so you took the you took the name of the tour very literally, perhaps too literally, and you're like, if I'm going, I take Nick with me. But I mean, this is what he wants.
Right,
He didn't wear a
exactly.
mask to sing.
No, exactly. Right. This one's called White Elephant.
Yeah, they all sound the
That's a good initiation to Nick, though, dude. That's the one. That's the only way, because
Yeah, it was
that
great.
was smaller venues too. So that's the way to get we got it. I don't know if you
Sure,
had it like
sure.
that,
Yeah.
but yeah.
It was the Royal Albert Hall, so pretty big.
Oh,
bigger
okay.
than, your local. And then seeing Nick at the so not too long after Ghostine had come out. So it was like the closest thing to a Ghostine kind of tour, I think. At the festival in Victoria Park, All Points East, in London, so East London, literally, so very close to me, like 20 minutes away,
Oh,
and that's
very
amazing
cool.
because you can hear that stuff from your house anyway, but obviously it sounds better when you're in it.
And not only that, but when you're with a crowd who knows every song and who's just like brought together,
Sure.
it blows my mind. As I've been like watching some of the Ireland, I think it was in Dublin with the first show was the first show in Dublin on this tour, I think.
I believe so.
Yeah, it's just like I just keep forgetting what a back catalog he has now. Like it's insane. I was like.
Yeah. It kind of places him like in alongside like Bob Dylan and stuff. Obviously Dylan's longer, bigger
Yeah.
back catalogue. But in terms of in terms of like sheer number of songs and depth and range, it's comparable, I think.
Yeah. It's insane. It's just, and it's good. Like it's all good. And I love that he has Papa Won't Leave You Henry's in the set and City of Refuge is in this, like these like gems that aren't the hits, but they're just like important songs on those old records, you know?
It makes a difference, right? It really makes a difference.
But he has to do Red Right Hand, and there's some have to, right? It's like From Her to Eternity, always. Red Right Hand, always. Oh Children, always. I think always. I don't know. Who knows?
He does that a lot. He does that Children loads. And I think also The Mercy Seat,
Yes,
which is in
Mer
like there's some statistic. I think it's the most played song, and it's in most of the sets.
Wow. That's the one song too, and Nick has said this before. I don't know why Mick Harvey has co-writer on it. So I think every time it plays, Mick Harvey gets a bit of cash. And I feel like,
Sure.
yeah, it's Nick's lyrics, but I think Mick really came up with the musical arrangements in my thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's the story. I mean, there's so many weird kind of experimental atmospheric things going on there. And that really, gives the track a large part of its ambience. So there's obviously the piano, but then there's like I think there was supposed to be a lot of hitting the piano strings and stuff, and like weird like added strings and clanging bits of metal and stuff. And so all that kind of percussive rhythmic stuff is kind of what drives it on. And you hear the difference when Nick does it solo on piano, which is really good, really effective. Because you think, oh, the actual chords and the music won't be up to so much. But it's great, it's great solo as well.
Yeah, that's I used to crack up because I would watch Blixa Bargeld and you would it was like he wasn't doing anything. He would strum like every maybe 10 seconds on some of those stuff on some of those live shows. But I found out he does crazy stuff with his guitar setup where he'll connect it through the bass drum, so the bass drum will trigger a sound onto his guitar. He's like totally in
Okay.
Einstürzende Neubauten mode, and he does all this like weird little stuff that's like soft and kind of in the background. So when he does one strum, there's like sometimes 14 things happening, and I used to just crack up because I'm like, what is he doing? He does one strum and that's it. It's like, no, it's his setup, dude. It's his setup. That's the genius.
Literally triggering. But I mean, he always had that great line where he said, "I didn't join, a rock and roll band to play guitar." And it's like, what? Such a strange remark, but like when you see him and stuff, you know what he means. But he delivers great like atmospherics generally, and I didn't realize until late in the writing of the book he delivers like the killer scream in
Stagger Lee. No, not Stagger Lee. Was it
thank
Stagger
you,
Lee? Yeah.
yes, Stagger Lee. And I always thought it was more like a drill, and it's him just going howling down the mic. It's
Yes.
fantastic. And
Yeah.
it really makes it,
And do you know what? On their live shows, they use his scream.
that's gotta be some cash as well,
Yes.
press
Yeah,
the button.
exactly. Exactly. Blix's get it's like every time Stagger Lee comes on, it's like boom, do the beginning. Blix just hears money going into his bank account.
Press the button, ka-ching.
Yeah.
But I mean, good for him. It's a great scream. It's probably paid for his kitchen or something,
Exactly. It's such a fun. Wait, what was Because I know you've written other books about Nine Inch Nails, and what was the other book? You've done three, right?
The other book's Silhouettes and Shadows. So it's all about Bowie in the year of 1980 when he was making the Scary Monsters album.
Cool.
So it's kind of a year in the life, but really like digging down on the individual tracks and the transition from, you know, what we call loosely the Berlin trilogy phase, becoming more commercial, poppier again, and then the really big, weird step into Let's Dance in 82, was 83 even, which is a whole other thing.
And with Bowie, the Berlin years were also with Iggy Pop, right? Like, that's kind of when he took Iggy Pop under his wing, and they both went to Berlin, if
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah, yeah. They seemed to have worked, like, freakishly well together, and it was like Chateau d'Eleville or something. So, you know, in France, that was mostly low. And then Heroes is the main album that's actually in Berlin, you know, at the at the Hansa Studios by the Wall and so on and so on. And then Lodger, I think, is all over the place, but mostly Switzerland, you know.
Yeah.
Tax Dodge, Bowie moved there, so on and so on.
Interesting.
But yeah, I always thought that was weird, that strange Berlin connection between the two of them. Because they're different decades, really, you know.
Yeah.
Cave was there in the 80s.
Right.
And it's such an 80s place. Like, the music he made there is so un-80s. It's really weird. Almost seems more like the 70s again, you know.
Yes.
Hard to put your finger on.
Yeah. And do you feel that that's where there's a lot of Blixa Bargeld influence coming into Nick's life at that point?
Yeah, I think so, because I think the songs and the albums really developed. Like, so one of my favorite albums of theirs overall is from Heads of Eternity, Your Funeral, My Trial.
Oh,
which I
yeah.
think is it 87? Maybe earlier. I think it's 87.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really strange, once again, very atmospheric album. A lot of really slow-paced songs. And I think that's where Cave found more of the ability to step back, have the piano in there, work perhaps a little bit more on the lyrics.
Yeah.
And then bring in the other band members a little bit more, rather than just being a straight backing band. And something like Stranger Than Kindness is, you know, is ridiculously good song. I don't know if it comes up much in the live sets these days, but that has Blixa doing his, you know, atmospheric tremolo guitar thing.
Yeah.
And it has obviously Anita Lane with her. I think she's largely responsible for the lyrics.
Yeah.
So sung by Cave, but largely written by her. So in a way that it doesn't quite entirely feel like his song, but it's such a weird atmospheric thing. But then he has something like Sad Waters, which on the solo piano live at Alexandra Palace, so during COVID album, he recorded in a big empty room, you know, videoed. Sad Waters is one of those songs that like really stands out, which is Cave and the vocals and the piano. It's one of his, it's definitely one of his stronger compositions, I think.
Interesting. I gotta go back to that one, because that's such a great record, man. That whole Your Funeral, My Trial, Tender Prey, right in there is just so, it was so in the pocket for that was Nick Cave's signature. And then as Nick Cave does, he goes, okay, now it's not our signature anymore. We're doing blank, which is what I love about him. And also sometimes it takes me a while to grab onto the new thing he's doing. Like even with Wild God, I liked Wild God. I didn't diss Wild the God. And then now Wild God is in heavy rotation on my turntable a lot. And I just keep listening over and over. And I'm like, there is something here that is just, it's intense. It's so good. What are your thoughts? What's that? What are your
do
thoughts?
You think,
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, God, do you see it as like a return to more accessible singer-songwritery Nick Cave, or do you see it as like another step change again?
I see it more as a step change because he's leaning into the spiritual, and I think he did. He's leaning into it in a way where that change felt similar to Abattoir Blues and Lyre of Orpheus, because he leaned in.
Okay. Yeah.
He really leaned into some esoteric, what do you call it? Songs, like songs that felt like he was channeling astrology and kind of deeper meanings. And this feels like it's a natural progression of Nick Cave, not in his 40s, but in his late 60s. And he's bringing it back, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I found it interesting. It's not my favorite. Mm-hmm. I'm a diehard late trilogy Push the Sky Away, Skeleton Tree, and Ghosting. Committed fan.
Yeah.
And so it feels a little bit like giving the people what they want, which he said he wouldn't do. And there's some interesting stuff on there, like when he has the vocal sample, I think it's Anita Lane and stuff, then they kind of warp it. I really liked that and like kind of looped it. It was really interesting. It was a bit more like the electronica that they kind of had going on Ghosting. But okay. I always sort of thought he might maybe take that further. It doesn't mean he never will, but I mean, for me, it's not something I'd necessarily jump to, but I think in the live setting, it's different. And you make a really good point that it resembles a lot Abattoir Blues, because it has that big gospel influence and that big kind of like crowd sound behind it, you know?
And I think that phase never changes. I think he's really into his gospel singers, the call and response, and even looking back at the old records, like even going back to Tender Prey and Your Funeral, My Trial, I didn't realize how much, or earlier records, there's so much call and response. Like, oh my God, what's the song? Wings of Desire on the first record, or not Wings of Desire. But it's close to that. It's Wings of Desire is a movie. Wings of Fly is a song. There's From Her to Eternity, and then there's Well of Misery. Well of Misery. Do you remember that song?
Oh yeah.
That's all call and response. And there's old videos of them where it's just like the backing band's trying to remember when they were playing as Nick Cave and the Cavemen. And it's just like Barry Adamson. And I think Hugo Race might have been, or no, Roland. I forgot what his name was, the Roland guy. And then, but it was call and response. It's like, and in that well of misery and down that well of misery, it was call and response happening without the gospel act. It's like, he's been doing that all along. He snuck it in, man.
Yeah. I think, it's interesting you mentioned that. And I think like vocalization, you know, like voices sound more is, really strong in the newer stuff, especially around like Ghosting, because it was largely him and Warren Ellis, you know? And it has that. The reason I said electronica might have been pushing it a little bit, but it's very synth led, you know, and there's not really much of a band sound behind it. So I really liked that, how they played with the twin voices going in and out and the falsetto and things.
Yeah. There was one song, and I think it was only when they did the Dig Lazarus Dig tours, they played What We Call Upon the Author. And there was something about, I enjoyed the song. Yeah, as an author, I'm like, sure, I'll give it even more thumbs up. But I don't feel like it was strong. but in the live setting, when they had the bass, when they had the breakdown, when it does a, when it just like changes like that, it was that it was so powerful live. Like they had that cranked where it almost like just blew your hair back a little bit. And then they would cut back to the song, like the live version can never, the original version can never replicate what they did live with that song. And it's just like it can't even be interpreted, because they went so hard onto that electric. There was a little bit of electronica sound in the song, and then it cuts back to.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. They did have that all over Dig Lazarus, didn't they? And I think you really hear it come to the fore a bit on like Push the Skyway, but also like on the Carnage album, like is it White Elephant or is it Elephant Gun?
White Elephant, yeah.
Thank you. And it has like the moody like beat synth thing that's on. Sounds like an elephant. Yeah. And he's doing this whole lumbering marching thing. And then that ends in like this huge gospel flourish. It's like Lennon's "Happiness is a Warm Gun." I don't know if it's intentional.
Oh, interesting.
I pointed to that in the book.
Okay. Speaking of the book, when did you decide my next book is on Nick Cave? What was your? I'm going to spend 2 years or 3 years or however long it took. To create this,
Years.
To it's just like I'm gonna take this time in my life to do a Nick Cave book. What was the decision on that?
To be honest, it was very much a spur of the moment thing, and I think it's one of those I didn't choose Nick Cave, Tony. Nick Cave chose me. Yes. By which I mean. Because it's not authorized at all, but by which I mean I was really seized with the compulsion to write about that late trilogy of records. I wanted to write about Push the Sky Away, Skeleton Tree, and Ghosteen, partly because Cave himself referred to them as a loose trilogy, and they show a kind of arc of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds reaching a really new, strange, brilliant peak with Push the Sky Away. And it is very different from the other records. Mick Harvey was out all of a sudden, which isn't like, and this isn't to do down his contribution, which is massive, but it wasn't like, oh, there's no guitars anymore. Whereas, everyone's looking for Mick Harvey or listening for him, but it must have changed like the dynamic and the situation a little bit. And yeah. I guess there was probably some kind of mutual thing there where he's like, I don't want to do these anymore because he'd done so many records. So his departure did seem to give them a little bit more space and openness. And then Skeleton Tree is almost kind of the inverse of that. It's very stripped back, a bit more electronic. And from what I read, the band like went to Paris and had like basically a load of quite abortive kind of recording sessions, ended up coming back to Brighton and finishing the album. But it was very punked down, more stripped back. It was already very gloomy. I think it was supposed to be 2/3 finished before Nick had the tragic loss of his son Arthur.
Yeah.
So, it was already going into a certain kind of territory, and then it became about, I think, sort of like the slightly overwhelming abyss of grief. And then Ghosteen has a weird kind of split personality where the songs are quite beautiful, quite ethereal, you could say very open-ended, quite less structure than those other records, like less verse chorus. And that gave him some more freedom to experiment alongside Warren Ellis, like the vocalizations we're talking about. And I think what that really did was like open things up for him, that songs don't have to be a certain way. They can be literally more impressionistic, more expressionist purely. And the result of that record was looking kind of like the aftermath of grief. So a few years down the line, where are you now? How do you see, how do you live with loss? And how do you continue your life beyond that? So I loved that weird, strange, very powerful, quite unique situation that three records had. I was interested to try and pick what connected them. And then Nick announced he was doing his Carnage book, which was obviously conversations between him and the journalist Sean O'Hagan during lockdown. And they went back and forth, talking about loads of stuff, a bit about the songs, but loads about life and loss and death and so on. So I kind of felt that Nick had already covered that territory. And in some ways, to try and do it on top of that was maybe overstepping the mark. So I would say somewhat unfortunately, I think the book's still good, but I had to like massively broaden my scope do loads more research, hammer down on the different relationships between the different records across the decades, as you say, because there's so much material. And that was great fun, especially like learning more about Nick's literary influences and the direct influences and references he made to the Bible. Yeah. But it wasn't necessarily my first intention. So that was a bit of a challenge, you know?
It's a challenge, but do you feel that way on, like, that happens to probably on most of, well, it happens to me on most of my projects where I'm like, this is where I'm going. This is the angle. And then all of a sudden it all breaks apart and it's like so much more daunting than I thought it was ever going to be in my life. And that's the challenge. Mm-hmm. But that's where I also hit the sweet spot, because it's just like, oh, wait, I didn't know it was going to be this hard. And now I'm going to push through it. And pushing through it brings the good stuff.
I'm going to say yes and no.
Okay.
Not
okay.
Because I disagree directly. But like, I know what you mean. I know what you're referring to. I think my idea would have been that I'd had some sort of crash course interjection, that I might have been doing a super big, broad Nick Cave book, and then I've been forced into the trilogy type situation. That would have been my preference. So the inverse of reality, I guess everyone says that. But I know what you're referring to, where you have to pivot a little bit. And my logic has always kind of been, especially if you're struggling personally at the time or the workload or whatever, is that you kind of write your way through it. Mm-hmm. So writing your way through it will normally see you through most of the problems and the issues. It's not necessarily the answer to everything else, but it can definitely, bridge some of the difficult stuff. And I think like that keeping your head down and focusing on the writing, it never really lets you down. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that everyone will like it. Doesn't mean that you've necessarily done a great job or it's the best thing you've done or whatever. But I guess it's a way of staying true to yourself. And you feel better because of that.
Yeah. And at the same time,
but I'll let you know.
You'll let me know?
Yeah, come back to me in 10 years.
Okay, yeah. Oh, no, we don't want to do that, because it's just like, it's almost like when we go back on our old writing, it's just like, it's just been milk that's left out of the fridge for us. You know, it's not for people just coming up to it. They're coming up to it and going, oh, this milk is perfect for my coffee. But for us personally, usually by the time the book comes out, it's already curdled.
Yeah.
and we're pretending that we care as much as we did when we hit the end.
I love that analogy. It really rings true as well, painfully so. And you're like, what the hell were you doing? What's wrong with you? It's like that's a terrible verb choice. And people are like, what's a verb? And you're like, God damn it. Like, I can't talk to anyone. You know, I can't live with myself. I can't talk to the reader.
Yeah.
They won't see all the flaws and the struggle that you might have had, hopefully.
Right.
Which is a really nice feeling.
Yeah, and that's not for them, because that's for the writer. For them, they pick it up and go, oh, I'm politely entertained by this, or oh wow, I need to find out more about this Nick Cave person, which Nick Cave needs to send you some of the he needs to send you a little love and some cash, because you're steering people his way. So not that he needs more steering. What's that?
But he doesn't have it spare. I don't think he's he's heavily invested. But I mean a cool thing recently, I had like a really nice little review in Record Collector magazine, which is kind of perfect. And it's kind of people like treasure their LPs, their old LPs, or like, you know, want to collect all the new Nick Cave reissues and stuff. And that was lovely. And 5 stars, of course. But I just said,
oh, good. Yeah. Amen. Go
and the review was really nice, but it was like, he's like, yeah, almost obsessive attention. And I was like, well, that ticked a box, surely.
Yeah.
You don't want under obsessive.
Yeah.
Like, I forgot to mention this album, or, you know, forgot that Nick Cave dyed his hair black. Yeah. You know, the important stuff.
Forgot that Nick Cave did his hair to be full again. I forget what they call that.
Oh, no, no, no. Yeah, but not even that. Not even that. I'm not even being cruel. I'm saying, like, from
I'm trying
like
not to
teenager,
be cruel. Yeah,
he dyed it black all this time.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Yeah.
I always assumed he had black hair.
Yeah.
So he must have been, like, super consistent. Like, terrible, crippling heroin addiction. Must buy hair dye.
Yeah.
I remember to do that.
Keep it black. And also keep those sideburns black. Keep it all black, my man. Keep it all black.
And a dark suit. Not necessarily black, but consistent.
Yeah. And
clearly consistency pays off, right?
Yeah.
Clearly so. And
it's like doing that, he doesn't have an embarrassing period in his life. Like, there's no Vanilla Ice years, you know?
Yeah, true.
There's no hammer pants. He went hammer pants and on three records, and then he's like, maybe hammer pants isn't a great idea.
Yeah, and you can't backpedal from hammer pants. But a suit rule is a classic. But I mean, he is that weird thing. I think you said at the start, like, is an amazingly consistent artist. Like, there's not a bad album. There's albums I love less, and people will fight you over that, you know. I quite like the album with Four in a Crew and stuff on it.
The Good Son.
The Good Son's got some great stuff on, but I don't think it's a particularly like all-embracing record.
No.
But like, there's always good stuff. And some people don't really love the album from 2001.
The one with Babe, I'm on Fire. Is that the one?
No, that's like 03. This is No More Shall We Part. Oh my God.
Oh, that's a good one.
And No More Shall We Part is fantastic, and it's huge, and the songs are really long, and there's loads of build-up songs, and they're like 7 minutes. And it's great. It's really consistent, you know? It's just very long and very intense, and, you know, there's loads of funny stuff on there too, but like some great jokes. But that's a massive record.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's a bit of a tough to get through the whole thing, but it's great for like a journey. And I mean that in the best possible way. You know, it's like, it stays with you and it takes you places and like the stories and things. And I think some people are like, oh, it's too much. Whereas like Abattoir Blues is fantastic. You know, both sides are like equivalent. They're both really strong, and it's really interesting, and it's really fun. And there's really sad songs and really like songs. It's incredible.
Yeah. You know? Like No More Shall We Part is Nick Cave in love. Like Nick Cave and Early Love, Nick Cave and Honeymoon Love, which is fun.
Yes, literally.
At the same time, do we want to see that? Well, I do, because I love the idea of that romantic beauty of the beginnings of a relationship, especially now, because he and Susie have gotten through the death of their son, which is not an easy thing to do. It breaks a lot of couples up. So it's almost like,
yes, Cave said that, didn't he? He made that very explicit.
Yeah,
I'm quite thankful to have come through it all. Really,
that could have gone the other way, and I feel like, you know, it has nothing to do with us when it's their relationship, but at the same time, that they got through it, like that means something to me. That means that there's like true. It almost like means there's true love out there, somewhere. I'm not in it right now, but someone's getting true love. And you know what? if Nick Cave, who was with PJ Harvey, and that went crash, and all these other people that went crash before, and then he all of a sudden found the right one to take the rest of life through. Well, then there's hope for me. Then there's hope for me.
Hope for everyone. Hope for everyone.
Hope for everyone.
Say good for you, right? No, I agree. And actually, it's interesting you mention that, because it's like, it is, I like the Red Hand Files, but I'm also quite, I think, reasonably respectful of that stuff. And I don't want tabloid, you know, ridiculousness, but he does put loads of it into the records. And also he shows that, that journey, that experience through the songs, like, you know, specifically explicit songs like I Need You on Skeleton Tree.
Yeah.
And there's this great moment, which I added in the book. And I thought, well, if it was more, shall we say, private and precious, you know, I would think like, well, I'd leave it out. But when he was playing at All Points East that year, you know, he was performing I Need You towards the end of the set. And there was like a strange breathless pause moment where, you know, he seemed to like really well up. It was just him on the piano. It's a very quiet, intimate song. And he just seemed to like lose it a little bit. And then the audience took up the lyric, you know, and like sang on his behalf. And he was brought back into the song and encouraged and buoyed up by everyone. I mean, you can't really ask for much more of a transcendent exchange between performer and fans, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's the best bit of the book, and I just revealed it. The bit, I don't need to read it now.
I'm sorry?
I'm saying that was the best bit of the book, perhaps. Now people don't need to read it.
for everyone to read. It's cool to be a part of the Nick Cave conversation the way you've brought yourself in because of the book. I mean, I feel like there's other books out there that were also unauthorized biographies that I didn't like that much. I came out more in the 90s, but when I got to read yours, and I think I read an early copy of it too. I think you sent it over. Yeah, you sent it over to me early on.
Yes, you did.
And yeah. And it was just like, oh man, this is good. This is really good. Okay. That it's yeah, it yeah.
I appreciate that, and if I remember rightly, there was no notes.
Yeah, I think you may have asked me for notes, and I'm like, no. Can I just say this is great? That's all I got, man. And at the same time, anyone reaching out and says, "Do you want to read my Nick Cave book?" I'm like, oh, not really.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about it. I mean, it hasn't happened to me yet, but yeah. When it does, I'll be nervous.
Right, because it's just like, oh no, I immediately go, oh, I'm gonna be disappointed, and also I have no problem just kind of going, oh, it's really nice you wrote a book about him, and not say anything bad or good, just be like, good on you for doing the project, fella. But I'm glad you reached out to me, because I was excited. I was like, oh, we got a good one, and that's just jubilee. That's the triumph. That's festivity.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was, as we're talking, like, you know, two fans and two writers, it was, you know, it was a labor of love. I really enjoyed doing it, and I think the scary thing is I could have gone on forever, and I think I could have written like double the book, which no one really wants. No one actually wants, pardon me, to be overloaded. They don't want too much of the good thing. They want a neat, concise, managed, you know, measured exploration. And it did still give me a lot of flex to lean on, like I say, those later albums. And I guess the big bonus for me was that I could talk about connections and themes running all across the discography, you know, and certain key songs that I love, you know, that I talked about, like Sad Waters and Stranger Than Kindness from such an early album. Mm-hmm. Really, really standout tracks that don't necessarily get played live so much, but you know, really strong and really interesting and really different, even just within the Nick Cave discography, you know.
Yeah, with the idea that you could have done double the material, have you thought about an idea of a follow-up? And it doesn't have to be a follow-up like of the same formula that you did, but maybe a follow-up of like a more personal journey of yourself through the writing of that story, the writing of that book in some way.
Does this mean people don't want Darker with the Dawn 2, you know, Nick Cave, the next 20 years?
Well,
right there alongside you.
There's that too. I mean, because I think he turned 60. He's turned 69 this year. So when he's 8, and I do not see him quitting touring for at least another 10 years. Like,
or even just stopping anything. He's literally had that like second life type boost.
Yeah. Like, you know, some celebrity deaths, you're just like, oh, yeah, that's a bummer. Oh, yeah, that's a bummer. I mean, Michael Hutchins' death, like, that was a real bummer. I was just like, oh, man, that was a rough one. But when Nick Cave dies, like, I'm going to collapse. We're all going to die. And, I you know, I'm younger than him, so I hope he dies before I do. Not that that, you know, I want to live at the
context,
same time.
Context, yeah.
Yeah, there is some expiration dates when you're hitting 100 and I'm, you know, in my 80s or whatever it turns out to be. It's, you know, it won't be as surprising because we'll be like, you went George Burns on us. But man, I hope he goes 100 because another 30 years of composition would just be off the hook. Yeah.
I just do. You know, I genuinely wish him, like, you know, a good 20, 30 more years of just, you know, living his life again. It's good. It's nice to see. But I mean, to answer your question properly, which I realize I don't always do. I'm looking at different stuff. I wanted to do some more writing about Gil Scott Heron. I think that there are books in and around him. He's written about himself and his life so well, but I kind of think there's some gaps there to re-examine his discography, like influence and breadth of ideas. Mm. And someone who was a real game changer in the biggest sense, who we can never really fully quantify the scale of influence. It's just massive on the world, really, which I guess makes it more of a challenge. So that's something I'm interested in. I've been doing a lot more freelance articles, bits and pieces, which is surprisingly time consuming. So freelance pays better for now. But it's very sketchy because you're going around pitching and, you know, I've always done bits in the past, but I'm trying to do a bit more now. Whereas books is increasingly squeezed. You know, it's really unfair, if I can use that term. Not necessarily that publishers are giving people a bad deal, but the market, ugly word, but the book market overall is kind of squeezed. And it's nice that there's, you know, new platforms of media. Like, I love podcasts, mm-hmm. but not all books can be a podcast. And not all podcasts should be transcribed and churned out as books, for example.
Right.
There's good examples of that, but generally I don't think it works so well.
And at the same time, there's... go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you know, it's a lot harder to do books now.
Yeah.
So people are willing to put the time and the work in, but the rewards, or rather the payoff, is perhaps not very sustainable, which really puts people, you know, kind of puts them up against the wall, so to speak.
At the same time, when you're pitching your freelance articles, I feel like it gives you a lot more, like, gravitas for your take on it from the publisher. They'd rather have yours because you have publishing deals and you've done the hard work of a book. And so I think that elevates you to the top of a pitch instead of, you know, possibly in the middle. I think that just, it almost gives you like a PhD in that arena without having to get a PhD.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think, like, that it's very good practice for, like, your mind and your writing skills and your, you know, your interests. I mean, you know, like lots of people, I'm interested in lots of things. And I think the way we define writers is they're kind of interested in everything.
Yeah.
Not literally, but, like, They're interested in people, for example. A lot of people aren't so interested in people, I find. They don't really listen so much to what they say, or they'd rather talk about themselves. And I'm, you know, I'm definitely guilty of all of that. But, like, I like to hear about new, different people, you know. So that's always cool. And so I think, like, freelance gives you this really great, like, opportunity to, like, 1,500 words, 2,000 words, to really nail down on something. Whereas a book is the... macro situation of that, where, you know, it gives you this massive scope and it's about you reining it in to make it manageable and approachable again. So, you know, both ends of the spectrum are great, but quite a bit of juggling, a bit of you know, development going on there to transition between the two, or to try and run them concurrently.
I also think that it's just good for our brains and souls to be able to write well-crafted books and well-crafted articles. It's just, if in general, mm-hmm. I encourage everyone to, like, write books and do it poorly and try to understand the craft, because it's just
I feel like the book is the gift itself. Like if the book is written, that's the gift itself. Oh yeah, now I got to go try to find a publisher or an agent to get it out to the world. Mm-hmm. That all feels like secondary now. It used to be so important on my first book, but now it's like, this has already given me everything I want. Oh wait, but other people might dig it too. Okay, well let's see what the market has to say, and we'll see.
That's really impressive, Tony. I think that's really noble. I think I'm still looking for that buzz of having a new big project to properly sink my claws into and my teeth. But I know what you mean, because like a lot of these things, once you've done the first time, like, you know, you'll never quite feel like your first publishing deal, because that was very, very exciting. That was very cool.
Yeah.
It was such a whole new little world thing. And then a little bit, when you've done a couple more books, you're like, oh yeah, books. I kind of have a handle on that. I kind of know books. Blah, blah, blah. And you don't, because things are always changing and there's the next thing.
Yeah.
So the thing that's been kind of, I think, good about, let's say, the writing journey and stuff is you're finding out new stuff about your subjects, kind of the whole point. You're having new thoughts as you go, which is great, because like you said, the book can change shape quite a bit and focus as you're doing your writing and your priorities change. But also your approach to the next book is always like a little bit new, a little bit exciting, and something different, you know. So there's always a degree of novelty. And I think we shouldn't take that for granted. And books, you know, books are just so important. Like, I can't remember who it was who said it, but lots of writers say this, that if you're gonna be a writer of any kind, you have to read. And read. And it's a bit like, if you're going to write about music, you need to listen, listen, listen. So you need to really listen across the discography of the person you're going to write about. But, you know, words are literally your fuel. And, like, it's not about aping. It's about, like, reading lots of different writers and always reading. You get so much. And then when you do your writing, hopefully what you do is completely different. It's your own individualistic thing, for good or ill. And the books, for me, the books really sustain you in that way. So in some ways, I'd kind of be happy if I never had to or never chose to write another book. But I'd be dead freaked out if I couldn't read new stuff. You know what I mean? That would be a weird world.
I try to read an hour a day, and it's just because it's the conversation. It's like having a conversation, but with the author on the page. And then I am the author putting words on a page. So it's keeping the conversation going in that medium, which I think is important.
Yeah. And they live through being read. It's a nice thing. Yeah.
The book is called Darker with the Dawn, Nick Cave's Songs of Love and Death. His name is Adam Steiner. Adam, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony. A pleasure, as always.
One moment away. The troops are free.